This is your podcast for all things refinishing. I'm Lane Ball with Zebras Before and After. Welcome to episode 197.
I think that artists can be a little bit modest about their work, but I think probably for me, usually I am, but that one I think might be my favourite that I've done. It just feels really close to my heart and I really enjoyed painting it.
In our Uncovering Art segment, Chloe Kempster with Chloe Kempster Design tells us all about her hand-painted floral sideboard. It's one of Chloe's favorite pieces, and as she discusses it, you'll know why. It truly is beautiful. Jenna with Touch of Townsend shares a refinishing tip on how she preps her pieces. In our If This Piece Could Talk segment, we feature a special piece that Jennifer with Save by Design purchased and refinished that has an interesting story that spans from its origination in the UK to the US. You won't want to miss it. This week's question of the week, what is the hardest part of furniture refinishing, is answered by our furniture refinishing friends Caitlin with Caitlin Beals, Patty with Midlife Revival, Adriana with Refreshed and Revived, and Sarah V with Actually It's Vintage Co. Grace with A Touch of Grace gives accolades to Alyssa with Home Grow Furniture Design. Stay with us, friends. We have the inspiration, fun, and community that will platform your day. Edgar Degas, the famous French Impressionist artist, once said, "Art is not what you see, but what you make others see." Every day, thousands of furniture refinishers are doing just that with their work, and every day we see unique, beautiful pieces of art that have stretched the limit of creativity, bringing art to new levels of inspiration. Uncovering these unique pieces is what this segment is all about. We are excited to feature another episode of Uncovering Art. These new segments will give all of us the opportunity to explore a specific piece, what makes it unique, and how the artist achieved the design. Uncovering the details, uncovering the art. Today we are uncovering a beautiful hand-painted floral sideboard by Chloe Kempster with Chloe Kempster Design. We hope you enjoy. Hi, Chloe.
Oh, hi, Lane. How are you?
I'm doing well today. I hope you are as well. Chloe, what do these colors have in common? Magenta, deep blue, teal green, yellow, and Carolina blue.
Well, they are definitely my favorite colors, but I think you must be talking about my abstract flower sideboard.
Yes, I am, exactly. And that's really what we want to discuss today in our Uncovering Art segment. Chloe, that piece was so beautiful, and you actually did a reel that showed a little bit of the process, but we want to really highlight that piece today and the art that went into it, all of the skill and talent that you have, and is showcased on this piece. Would you please tell us about this piece, describe it for us, and then a bit about the process?
Oh, that's really kind of you. I'm really glad you liked it. So actually, I think that artists can be a little bit modest about their work, but I think probably for me, usually I am, but that one I think might be my favourite that I've done. It just feels really close to my heart and I really enjoyed painting it. And it came easily, which sounds funny as well. Sometimes artwork can just be really hard to complete, you know, and it can take a long time to do, but it just came really naturally, that one. So I'm really proud of it. I actually did it for, I work on a TV show over here in the UK, and sometimes I work as a designer and we do up furniture that's been sent to be thrown away, basically, and we try and rescue it. So it was actually this really old oak sideboard, and I didn't like the details on it, so I kind of cut the legs off and I took the panels out and made it quite a plain canvas so that I could paint my floral artwork on it.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the before, and it is quite a bit different today than it was when you received it. So this piece was actually going to be thrown out.
Yeah, it was going to be thrown out. And if I'm really honest with you, I like a lot of vintage furniture, but this is the kind of vintage furniture that I don't like. Usually if I see it, you know, I'll pass it by and think, no, that's not for me, because I didn't like the, it's got really wavy legs and then kind of quite gothic panels, and it's just not my thing. So I wanted to get rid of all of that. And then I kind of added the detail back in with my own artwork, really. But it's very different now.
Now, the panels that were on the front, you said you took those. Are those all new panels, or did you just sort of reconstruct the panel?
Yeah, in the end, I was hoping that I could just take the trim off. I was hoping it was just trim and that I'd be left with a flat surface, but I actually had to cut the whole of the panel out because it was so well made back in those days, they joined everything together really well, didn't they? So I had an awkward moment with a jigsaw. Yeah, just I had to cut through it all with a jigsaw. It looked quite brutal, actually, and then replace the panels with wood. But I'm pleased with how it turned out in the end. But I have to say, I was a bit nervous at one point.
So you said that you took this piece, you had to make some adjustments to it to get it to where it was really more of a canvas for you to paint on. Tell us about the planning process of how you determined what you were going to paint on it.
Oh, so I knew that I wanted to do florals. That's just my thing. I really, really enjoy painting them. There's something about it. I just love the shapes and I love using lots of different colours. And I think when you paint florals, it really inspires you to do that. So, but yeah, I just knew florals. And to be honest, my process is very organic. I tend to just start by drawing some lines on the piece, really. That's really my only starting point is I just think, right, I'm going to draw some rough shapes on the piece. And then I kind of build from there and I paint around the lines I've drawn. Does that make sense? But it's quite organic. Yeah.
Now, do you do any, so you don't do any thumbnails at all before you start? You just get the furniture piece to sort of a canvas orientation and then you start painting.
Yeah, I just go with it and I just start painting. I usually have an idea of a colour palette, but again, that can evolve. But usually I have a trolley, like a wheelable trolley, and I usually, before I start, I kind of put the colours I think, oh, they'd look quite nice on this. And I tend to just put them in that trolley so it's close by. And then I just see how it goes.
Now, for somebody maybe who hasn't done freehand painting on a piece, what about the prepping part? Now, you obviously, changed out the doors. You had to cut those panels out. Is there a lot of prepping work that goes into it, or is it just the way it is for any other furniture piece? I mean, you clean it, then you prep it, and then you have some sort of a base coat that you put down?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same process as any other furniture piece. I actually used a chalk clay paint on this. So it's not necessarily, you don't need to necessarily prime, but because I do it as a business and I do it professionally, I always like to make sure I do that anyway, because it can't do any harm. And also the varnish was quite flaky in places. And so I just really wanted to take that right back. And then I actually didn't need to prime with that. I used, I made sure it was clean. I made sure it was sanded down really well. And then I used this clay chalk paint as my base. And I think really the sealing is key when you do artwork on something, because often I'll mix materials. So I might have chalk paint, I might have a clay-based paint, and then I might use a paint pen, something like that. So I'm mixing materials. So I'm quite hot on sealing it afterwards so that it's all sealed in at the end, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. That's so interesting. So you're not exclusive to one specific type of paint. I mean, you're using multiple paints in one project.
Yeah, I use multiple paints. Yeah, that's really something that's really evolved with me. I always feel as a bench painter, we feel like we have to use one paint. But, my background is as an artist initially. And I just want to experiment and I want to feel free and I want to get better at what I do. And I think it's like putting a child in a sweet shop and saying you can only try one type of sweet. and you don't want to do that, do you? You want to try everything.
That would be torture.
Yeah, it would. And that's what it's like. That's what I feel like. I just want to explore. And I think that the possibilities are endless when you mix things together. There's no rules, it's good to break them and see what you can achieve.
Now, when you drew out the floral pattern, did you use a paint pen for that?
Yeah, so I sometimes do. I was a little bit soft on this one, so I used a mix of a really fine detail brush to get the lines in, but also I have pastels, like paint pastels, and that's really from my background when I studied art. So I kind of bring in all of my art materials as well as the painting products to get it the way I like it. Yeah.
So this is all in your head. I just want to clarify that you're not looking at anything. You are drawing based on just your creativity and your talent, you're not. Do you have anything in your head that you're basically using as a guide? I know that sounds like a crazy question, but when I look at this piece, I mean, it's so, everything just works so well together. Not only the color, but the positioning of the flowers. And I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Oh, thank you. Genuinely, I'm a bit of a maverick when I paint. I've definitely got a style. I think everybody has a style anyway. And I think when you practice it and you do it over and over again, it just comes out, you know? And I think that's really important to me. I try not to look at too many things. I try to just really find my own style. But I think it comes with being brave and actually not worrying. It's just paint, and you know, if you go wrong, you can paint over again until it looks right. But you will always have, every person in the world will always have their own style, mm-hmm. and their own way of putting colors together. And but yeah, no, I don't, but I would in the future. I think it would be interesting to study, you know, florals, and then see mm-hmm. how that would look if I was actually looking at a flower and then painting it on the sideboard. I think that would be really interesting.
You sort of touched on my next question for you, and that was, is there much forgiveness in this process when you're doing freehand painting on a piece of furniture? And I, again, I know you, and you said this, you can paint over something. Did you have to do that on any part of this process where you're like, I shouldn't have put that there. I need to paint over that and sort of start over on that section.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, really? Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had kind of the rough idea that I wanted this really large, bold floral design, because I think florals can sometimes look a bit chintzy. Is that, do you know what I mean? Or old fashioned, and uh-huh. they look kind of almost too pretty. And uh-huh. I wanted it to be feminine, but, you know, modern and contemporary. And I think doing it on a large scale works well for that. But yeah, with the composition, because I do it from my head, often I'll think, oh, I didn't want that stem there, or that flower's wrong. And I actually had a deadline on this because it was for this show, uh-huh. it was going to be filmed, and I kind of got really close to the deadline, and I was thinking, God, this flower is just not going right. And you know, all the others went really well, and it was just this one section that I couldn't quite get right. But you know, you just persevere, and you can paint back over it. Sometimes I do. I just paint the whole section in the background color again and just start with a blank corner and just start again. And you'll get there in the end.
When you do that, when you do have to go back over and paint over something that you don't want there, do you have to sand that back over? Because you probably have some level of paint buildup, do you not?
Yeah, I think with some artists, they probably wouldn't. I think they like the idea that you can see the texture underneath, but I like it quite smooth and professional looking. So yeah, I will tend to just sand back a little bit so it's flat, just with really fine sandpaper, mm-hmm. and then just go back in and paint. Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier that you took the bottom half of the, well, probably shouldn't say bottom half, but you took the legs off, the old legs off of the piece. You did that. I mean, obviously, that was, again, because you knew you wanted this piece as a canvas. So that was an early on decision. That wasn't something that you decided later.
Yeah, that was my starting point, really. Mm-hmm. I knew I just wanted it to be a lot more modern, and the legs just weren't working. So they had to come off. And even at that point, I didn't know what legs I was going to replace it with. But it works really well. I put these modern brass legs on, and then it's got these brass handles as well. And I don't know, it just kind of brings everything into the 21st century. So yeah, I didn't know. I just got the saw out and sawed them off as level as I could, you know. And pleased to say it stands level now. It's straight. There's no wobbles.
Yeah, that's key, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is key.
Yeah, I love how the brass legs work so well with the hardware. And the hardware, I assume that was probably chosen at the very end.
Yeah, always with hardware. I always find that really tricky because often you're ordering online as well, aren't you? So you can't actually see. And sometimes the scale of it you want to put up against the piece. So I actually ordered a couple of options in the end, and I decided on these. But yeah, that's the very last. It's like the cherry on the cake, isn't it? The handles mm-hmm. and the hardware.
Yeah, it really does seal it. It adds to it and doesn't take away from, especially a piece like this, which is, you know, really a painting on the furniture canvas. Now, you stage this thing, and I want to talk about staging briefly, because when you get a piece like this that already has a lot going on and there's so much, you know, there's so much attention to this, there's so much drama to the piece itself. You just placed, at least on the image that I'm looking at, you placed a vase with, I can't see the top of it. It looks like some dried plumes or something coming out of the vase.
Yeah, like a kind of pampas, like yellow. It's like mustard yellow, isn't it? Like foliage, yeah.
Yeah, so just tell me about the staging and how you know how to stage, because a lot of folks, you know, struggle with that, and you know, it's always best to go simple when it comes to staging and then build off of that, but you staged this piece quite well. Was that pretty easy for you?
Yeah, I think sometimes the quite detailed pieces are they're tricky to stage because, like you say, there's a lot going on. So you have to kind of rein back on things a little bit, because I want people to see the piece and I don't want them to be looking at everything around it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So obviously I picked a color from the flowers that I'd done, this kind of mustard yellow color. And then I think, yeah, it's very simple. I mean, I work within my limitations because I have a very small space here at home, so my backgrounds are often like white wall, but it just works for the continuity, you know, and it shows off the piece, it highlights it. So I like to keep it simple, and I think with quite a detailed piece like this, that works the best.
You said you did this piece in conjunction with a television program that you are featured on. Are you on that show pretty regularly?
Yeah, I do a few. I've been doing the show for quite a few years now, 3 or 4 episodes for them. So yeah, it just keeps me on my toes, you know, keeps me thinking and keeps me moving forward.
Now, did you keep this piece? Do you still have it?
Oh, I sold it. I mean, in a way, it was one of the ones where I thought, actually, I wouldn't mind keeping that one. Some of them I'm glad to get rid, you know. You know how it is. I'm like, thanks, that's brilliant. I've got space in the corner of my workshop again. But yeah, no, it sold in half a day, this one. So 12 hours it was gone, it was sold. So I was really pleased about that.
I'm not surprised. Now, with respect to profit, the amount of work that you put into it and it really being, you know, an expression of your artistic talent when it comes to freehand painting, were you satisfied with what you were able to make off of it?
Yeah, I was. I mean, we always, because it's for this particular show, we always kind of set it a little bit lower so that they sell, so that they can, because the profit gets given. I get commissioned to do the piece, and then the profit's given to the person on the show who's going to throw it away. I wish it was in America so you could see it. So we keep it so that it flows and that we can film the shows. But you know, I was pleased. It is a tricky, pricing is so difficult in our industry, because it varies so much, and you've got people who are perhaps trying it out for the first time, or doing it as a hobby, and then you've got people who are doing it professionally, and you think, well, what price shall I put on it, you know? And sometimes with my artwork I can take hours on a piece, and other times I'll have a similar result and it might have only taken me a few hours, because it's just, you know, that's how it works with creativity and, you know, artwork. But no, I was happy with it. I think it's really important especially when it's bespoke and it's something that's very unique to you and you've put time and energy in, to ask the right money for it.
Now, please tell me your signature's on there somewhere. I'm looking and I don't see it.
Do you know, I'm glad you picked up on that. I've only just got the confidence to start putting my signature on my work. I never used to. And in the last year, I do. If it's one of those really, you know, bespoke pieces, I sign the back. So yeah, I sign and date the back.
Oh, that's so good to hear. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, we always try to encourage furniture artists to make sure you put your logo, your signature somewhere on the piece. That's so important.
Yeah, I think so, because it's a one-off, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's one of a kind. And, you know, think about, you know, how long these pieces, the majority of these pieces that are refinished, were made many years ago, and they were fortified by the refinisher. And so they're going to last, you know, many years on down the road. And it's great to have that information there for the next generation.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I'm going to sign a few more pieces in the future. But yeah, I did sign that one.
One last question for you, Chloe, and you did kind of touch on this earlier, but at least from the photograph that I'm looking at, it looks like it has sort of a matte finish to it. Did you coat it with like a matte top coat?
Yeah, so it has a top coat on here. Like, we're so lucky nowadays to have such a selection of top coats to choose from. I mean, I know when I first started, which was over 10 years ago, it wasn't quite the same. And I always struggled with things like that, but there's such a variety. And that is a, yeah, that is a matte, that's just a matte decorator's varnish on the top. So yeah, and then I use over the, it kind of matches, but because the florals are have certain details, like the pastel kind of crayons and things like that, I use a spray varnish on that area, and then I use a roll-on varnish on the rest. So yeah, it's a bit unorthodox, but you know, that's just I like to experiment.
Yeah, no, well, I suppose that's probably necessary so that you don't smear any of the pastels that are on there. That's really good information.
Yeah, that's how I do it, so it doesn't get disturbed. So I spray it and then I'll roll on the rest. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Chloe, for sharing the details behind this gorgeous piece. It's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, honestly, I'm so pleased you like it. I paint it, you know, with my heart. So when people like it, it makes me smile. Thank you.
You can find Chloe on Instagram at Chloe Kempster Design. We're going to take a quick break now to hear from our sponsor.
Hi, this is Laura from Redhead Refinishings. And this podcast is sponsored by my friends at Zebra. Zebra brushes are awesome because they are so lightweight and very easy to use.
Thank you so much, Laura, for sharing about your experience with Zebra paintbrushes. We so value our customer friends. Today's refinishing tip comes from Jenna with Touch of Townsend.
Hey everyone, I'm Jenna Townsend, the creator behind the account Touch of Townsend on Instagram. A tip I would love to share with you is prep work will make or break your overall paint results and durability. I know, no one really loves that prep work and we all just want to get to painting, but I promise you the final result of your painted furniture will thank you for taking those extra steps. When I prep my furniture pieces, I start with removing the hardware, of course, then I give the piece a good vacuum to remove any dust. Don't forget to vacuum the inside and also underneath the piece too. Next, I use a degreaser to clean all over. I found scrubbing it on with a brush gets in all those corners and edges so much better than just with a cloth. Then I wipe it all down one final time with warm water until no residue is left behind. Next, I move to scuff sanding, and I know there's a lot of comments out there whether you should or shouldn't scuff sand, and I'll leave that to you. But I will say I've never had paint scratch off of a scuff sanded surface, so I like to take the safe route and always scuff sand now. The last step to my prep routine is priming the surface with a stain blocking primer. This helps block your bleed through and gives your paint a smooth and even surface to adhere to. And that's it. Now you get to move on to the painting fun. I hope you enjoyed this prep tip of mine. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Jennifer, for sharing about the importance of prepping and sharing your own prepping process. Every piece you locate and purchase as a refinisher has a story. With some pieces, there is no information available to tell its story, but with many others, with the right sleuthing, you can find out something about your pieces in hopes of sharing the past along to the next generation. Discovering the history of your pieces and sharing them here on the podcast is the purpose of If This Piece Could Talk. Jennifer with Saved by Design is enthusiastic about digging deep into the history of her pieces and loves making that connection with the past. On today's episode, we visit with Jennifer and hear about a recent discovery she made on an old oak wardrobe. Enjoy. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Lane. How are you?
I'm doing well. I hope you are as well on this Friday. And I know this won't air Friday, but it's Friday. That's a good thing, right?
That's right. Best day of the week.
That's right. Well, thank you, Jennifer, for coming on our podcast segment. If This Piece Could Talk. We love hearing about the history of pieces, and we want to keep these stories alive. But you recently found a piece on Marketplace that has an interesting story behind it. We would love for you to describe the piece and then tell us what you learned about the history of this particular piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever I'm looking for pieces on Marketplace, I always try to find the ones that are not getting attention, because I feel like those are usually the ones that have the best stories behind it. And that played out true for this piece. Mm. So we found a wardrobe on there that I knew I could just tell by the detail work on there that it was unique. So reached out to the person that had it listed for sale. And honestly, I paid a little more for it than I normally would have, but I knew it was a solid investment. So when I got to looking at it, it looked kind of rough just because that old varnish had covered up so much of the good things. But I noticed first off that it was solid tiger oak, which is extremely rare. It had no veneer on it. So as soon as I seen that, I was like, oh, gotta have it. So I talked to the person that had it listed for sale for a little bit when we went to pick it up. And I'm terrible because I didn't really tell them what they had, but that's not my responsibility. So anyway, so I just kind of asked her, you know, she said that it had belonged to her mother. And of course, her mother had passed and she wanted it to go to a good home. And I said, well, it's going to a good home. I can guarantee that. So I asked her, how her mom had come across it. And the story behind it just got more and more interesting. We ended up buying an entire set from her that matched this wardrobe once I found out she had those pieces. So she said that her mother and father had actually been in the military and were stationed in London in the 70s. And that her mom, while she was pregnant with her, had been out shopping in the countryside surrounding London and come across an estate sale and seen this set there and loved it and had to have it. So her mother had purchased that, brought it back here to the States in 1976. And I was so surprised that it made it back in such good condition, because if you know anything about shipping a furniture from overseas, it's not good. Yeah. So, anyways, the family that her mother had purchased it from were the original owners of the set, and they lived in what you picture, a countryside estate outside of London. And so knowing that information, I got to dig in a little bit, and I pulled off the locks and the hardware, and I seen that the hardware was solid brass. So that was just a key right there that it had some good age to it. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking up if you'll pull off your locks or hardware, often you'll find even tiny maker's marks on there. Mm-hmm. I got lucky enough to find that the locks were made by Telescope, and that is an old English brand. So I searched that, trying to narrow down the area. And once I found that, I was able to narrow it down that this piece was actually made in Norfolk, England. So that was really exciting for us. And then we went ahead, there was a mirror in the center of this wardrobe that when we were looking at it, we could tell it was original. We didn't think it had been replaced. So reluctantly, we took the backing off of the door to check the mirror. And sure enough, there was a date printed on it in this old type of like ticker tape, I guess is what you would call it, September 16th, 1927. And it was just in amazing condition. And there are so many things, even if I had not found the brand that was on those locks, there were so many different features on that piece that could have helped me to narrow down that age. Mm-hmm. And I think it's such an important thing for refinishers to learn what to look for and to do that research, because a lot of times you have a diamond in the rough and you don't want to undersell yourself, and you also want to pay homage to the piece that you're working on, because it has a story. So it's so important to tell the story of those pieces.
It's so amazing as I look at this piece that, you know, realizing that she picked it up in England, shipped it over to the United States, that, as you said, that it's in such good shape, and that the mirror is, I mean, it doesn't look to have any cracks on it.
It has none. It was a blessing, because I could not believe it. I mean, it was, that just shows the craftsmanship of the pieces from our past, because when we took that backing off, it was, the mirror had been seated so well into the frame and supported so well by hand, you could tell it was done by hand, that it just speaks to the quality compared to the mass-produced furniture that we have nowadays.
Yeah, and the design, I've never seen anything like this. This is, do you think this was?
I think it was a craftsman. I really do. Because, again, all of these things, like, I mean, you can get lost in pieces researching the different trim work and everything. But a few things that made me think it was craftsman made would be, I could see handwriting on the backs of some of the drawers, you know, numbered. A lot of the, where the locks inserted and everything, you could tell were hand notched. They weren't done by machine because they had imperfections, which makes it so much better. All of the dovetail joints, you could tell, were done by hand. And the fact that it was solid, it had no veneer in it whatsoever, that's generally something you only see come out of a craftsman shop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. I mean, almost 100 years old, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we found pieces much older than that as well. And that's really where the skills of being able to identify the construction of a piece and the type of wood used in a piece is going to help you to age those, because they generally don't have maker's marks in them.
Yeah. Now, you may not know why this person sold it, but when you see something like this, that's an initial thing. It's like, why did you get rid of this piece?
I know. I think honestly what happens is when you run into these antiques, I think, unfortunately, a lot of times what happens with everything in our lives is that the value of it is lost when one family member intends for it to be an heirloom. Mm-hmm. And then that person passes and the younger generations just don't realize what they have or just simply don't care, and that's just the truth. And I believe, unfortunately, this happened twice to this piece, because when we purchased it, it was, of course, because of it being passed down after a death in the family. And from what I understand, the woman that purchased it in England, it was from an estate sale of those that had passed away. And I'll tell you one other thing, and this is kind of sidebar. What is so impressive to me is the fact, if you think about 1927, of course, that was before the Depression hit in the United States, but there was still a lot of poverty that was going on in Great Britain because of the First World War. Mm-hmm. And to know that someone was able to afford to have a craftsman-built wardrobe like this, not just this, but the entire set that matched at that time period, it gives you an idea of the social standing of this family that originally had this, because that was a luxury far beyond what many could fathom at that time.
Well, it's an amazing story, and I'm sure it's hard for you, because as you start digging, you sometimes hit a block wall.
You realize
you can't go any further, but you,
exactly.
Oh man, you want to go deeper and deeper. Yeah. But you're limited. But at least you did the work to get to as far as you could go with it, you know, to find out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you and your mom are, you know, turning around so much furniture, I mean, you're finding these pieces, you're bringing them back to your shop, putting all that work and effort, all that skill that goes into refinishing a piece. How do you keep from skipping over the history of these pieces? What effort? Like, because I really hope this encourages a lot of people. I know there are some that are already doing this.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you keep from getting the history of the pieces lost in the process of refinishing? Because it's a lot of work already, right?
So the first thing that we do is that we just consciously make this a priority for us. Because now, granted, let me first say, if I pick up a piece that I automatically know by looking at it that it's a fairly newer piece or at least something from the 70s and on, I'm not super focused on that. Mm-hmm. However, if I pick up a piece that I can tell is an antique, that I feel is pushing 100 years or more older, we make it a priority that before we do anything, we sit down and we first look the entire piece over. We look for types of wood used. We look for the types of joints on the drawers. We look for the types of nails that are put in there. We look for the backing and how that's put together. We see if there are, what type of hardware's on it. We literally do a full demo. We take off hinges, we take off locks, we take off hardware. We have taken off tops of dressers that we didn't even have to, and have actually found things stuffed up in there because drawers will open and close and things get pushed up in there. We have found a lot of actual tangible documents that we can put our hands on to date things. And then whatever we do find out about that, I mean, we've gone really deep. We have found names. We have researched those people. We've placed where these pieces would have come from and so on and so forth. And then what I like to do on our social pages is do a post about that piece before it's even refinished and say, this is what we know. This is where it came from. These are the people that it may have touched. And just honor the memories that go along with that, because oftentimes you're going to bring up the memory of a person or a place or a company that has been long forgotten. So I think that's just, you have to make that a priority for yourself because it's so important. And then you can move forward with the fun stuff from that point.
Yeah. And it's so worth it, isn't it? I mean, it's,
absolutely. Yes. It's, and we have what I call our box of goodies. We're going to have to start framing stuff of different things. We've found World War II newspapers. We have found checks from 1907. We have found pictures. We found handwritten letters from the wars, from their sweethearts. I mean, it's amazing what you can find if you just take that, you know, that extra hour or so to really dig into it.
When you discover the history behind a piece, does that affect your refinishing or the direction you take for refinishing that piece?
I think, yes, absolutely it does. Because I will say, and I think this is a good point to hit on, I'm pro paint. I love painting everything. But there are some pieces that I do feel like, and I'm not talking about for value-wise, I'm just talking about just paying honor to the craftsman that built those pieces. There are some pieces that I won't paint if they're beautiful enough without paint on them. This wardrobe is a perfect example. We literally, before I started this podcast, we just staged the final product and we stripped it down. It's natural. It was made so beautifully by the craftsman that we didn't have to do anything to it to make it better. When we do find true antiques like that, that are very, because not all antiques are good quality, and that's one thing to keep in mind. But when we do find antiques that are true quality like that, we just like to let it shine. Just clean it up and strip it down and just let what it is speak for itself. But also on the other side of that, antiques can definitely affect your value. And that's another reason in refinishing to do that research is not just for the history itself, but also know what you have, because you don't need to be selling something for $200. It's worth $2,000. So
Good
keep
point.
That in mind. Yeah, exactly.
That may make you cry at some point later on.
I've done it. Not quite that drastic of a price difference, but I have done it. And later on, I'm like, I'm almost regretting it, because honestly, the more you charge for a true antique like that, the more you know it's going to be cherished and it's going to be taken care of. And I think that's so important.
Yeah, very good. Very good point. Now, what about passing on that information as far as like telling potential clients, hey, this piece was from the 1920s. Here's the history behind it. Do you often pass that on to potential buyers?
We do. Every single time. When I find a piece that has, sometimes even pieces that don't have that great of a story, but when I find a piece that has a good story and I do know definites about the past and what it's made of and everything, I do a full description of that when I list a piece for sale. Even on Marketplace, Etsy, doesn't matter where I'm listing it, because I truly think that that is what separates those pieces from the mass production today. And I think it's important to, word of mouth is always going to be something that you can't burn the paper, you can't delete the file. You know, when you tell those stories to others, it's going to continue to get passed down for generations far past when we're here.
Well, this particular piece especially is just a phenomenal story and so much fun to learn about this particular piece. Well, Jennifer, thanks for taking the time to tell us about this piece and the history behind it. We hope to have you back on again soon.
Yes, absolutely. I'll be here for it.
Well, Jennifer can be found on Instagram at savedbydesign.tn. Today's question of the week is, what is the hardest part of refinishing?
Hi, I'm Caitlin Beals. My Instagram account is also Caitlin Beals. The hardest part of refinishing furniture for me is choosing a design and sticking to it. Once I get a piece cleaned and prepped, it's so easy to feel paralyzed in deciding whether to paint or fully remove the previous finish and stain a piece. The other part of refinishing that I avoid whenever possible is drilling new hardware holes. I have such a hard time getting dual mount holes level for some reason.
Hi, this is Patty from Midlife Revival. The hardest part of refinishing furniture for me, I would have to say, is the physical toll it has had on my body over these last several years. Repetitive motions, moving heavy furniture pieces, working with tools has resulted in wrist fatigue, back pain, shoulder pain, bruises, cuts, you name it, I've experienced them all. 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and I wasn't sure if I would ever be able to continue to refinish furniture. Thankfully, with weekly medication and training myself to work smarter using some different tools that help reduce the strain on my joints and muscles, I am now able to work again and hope to for many more years to come.
Hello, my name's Adriana. I am from Refreshed and Revived. And I would have to say the hardest thing about refinishing furniture is that last final step, which is sealing it with a top coat.
Hi, I'm Sarah V of Actually It's Vintage Co. on Instagram. When it comes to refinishing furniture, I find the hardest part is the amount of time and labor it takes to do all the prep work on a piece, starting with any surprise fixes and then making repairs to get the piece functional, then to going on hours of sanding, stripping, cleaning at various stages, detail work to veneer issues. All of these time-consuming things have to be done before going on to create a perfect finish. The hard work is worth it in the end, though, when you know the integrity of the piece is restored.
Thanks, Caitlin, Patty, Adriana, and Sarah V. If you have a general question you would like asked among your refinishing peers, send me an email at lane@enjoyzebra.com. If we answer your question on the podcast, you'll receive a free Zebra paintbrush. Accolades is defined as an acknowledgement of merit. Welcome to one of our newer podcast segments called, well, Accolades. We wanted to give refinishers the opportunity to give accolades to their fellow refinishers that they admire for their extraordinary refinishing skills and hard work. This week's accolades are given by Grace with a Touch of Grace.
So glad you're here. My name is Grace. I'm the creator and owner behind A Touch of Grace. I want to give accolades to Elisa over at Home Grove Furniture Design. I came across her account during a refinished furniture tour. She had just refurbished an outdated orange dresser into a dipped paint look with a whitewash, and she used Good Bones paint. It was gorgeous and it caught my eye. So like any other artist, I stalked her account for more furniture inspiration, and that's truly what I found. As I followed Elisa, I learned more and more about who she was, and I was able to connect and relate with her on so many levels. You see, she was a teacher before beginning her DIY journey, and like me, it allowed her to quit her teaching day job and start her 24/7 job of furniture flipping and being a stay-at-home mom. Just the other day, she had posted a reel in reference that, you know, she's a mom first, and how sometimes she gets hyper-focused when completing a project and that her kids can just feel it of her stress. And it really resonated with me as a mom of three, all under 3 years of age, that I usually am the one that sets the tone in my home, and seeing another mom in business going through the same exact thing, I was really encouraged, and it helped me feel like I wasn't alone. The DIY community truly is a family, and I'm so grateful that I happened across her account, because as I've been following her and her me, we've become not just admirers of each other's work, but friends. And that's what it's all about. It's about making connections to encourage and uplift one another. Teaching is engraved in our souls, and I hope you follow along with our accounts for DIY makeovers and you laugh with us as we juggle our busy and chaotic lives.
Thanks, Grace, and accolades, Alyssa. This month's Zebra Review Contest category feature is buffets. Our featured judge is Jen Talley with Perfectly Imperfect Furniture, and she will be choosing her favorites and then sharing those buffets with the remaining judges to then choose the top three. Those judges are Katie Cloud with Katie & Company, Katie Scott with Salvage by K. Scott, and Lauren Schwachino with Portland Rose Studio. In order to enter your refinished buffet, you must use the hashtag ZebraBuffets. You can enter any buffet you refinished in any style, any color, from January 1st, 2022 through the end of this month, November 30th, 2022. A big thank you to this month's sponsors, Surf Prep Sanding, D. Lawless Hardware, Melange Paint, and Zebra Paintbrushes. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to any of the judges or send me an email. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Zebra's Before and After Furniture Refinishing Podcast. Today's episode, along with information about today's guest, is also featured on enjoyzebra.com under the podcast tab at the bottom. Your comments and suggestions for future episodes are always welcome, and we encourage you to share them by sending your emails to me at laneball@enjoyzebra.com. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and happy refinishing.